Welcome to the Virtual Center for the Study of the American Constitution with your host, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Welcome to today's program. This is the Virtual Center for the Study of the U.S. Constitution. I am Bill O'Brien, and today is Wednesday, the 27th day of March in 2013, and we are glad that you can be with us today. Today we're going to focus in some depth on the very, very famous Federalist No. 10 document by James Madison on the Constitution of the United States. It is a document that we started to get into yesterday, but we ran into a few technical glitches, and somebody very kindly made the comment that that what I would explain to you today is that there were a few gremlins in the building yesterday. Most of the gremlins had the same initials as me, as I do. So it's my own lack of comfort with the technology that more than anything else caused it. But hopefully we'll be better today. The one thing that bothered me at the end of yesterday's program is I owe a lot more than that to James Madison. Very honestly, I feel that that this is a document that over the years, over the decades, has received so much attention. It is a very, very important document. It is one that really warrants serious attention and serious consideration, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to make it the focus of our attention so early in our series together. Let me begin, as I always do, by giving you the phone number and encouraging you to give us a call and engage in some dialogue and some banter back and forth here. I'm sure our listeners would appreciate it. I know I would as well. Our number is area code 304-658-3333. It's a very easy number to remember, 304-658-3333. And if you'd like, my email address is waobrien, one word, O-B-R-I-E-N, 906 at gmail.com. So let me give you the entire thing again. It's waobrien906 at gmail.com. And as I mentioned the last couple of programs, when I do receive emails or comments, I would like to open each program by, first of all, thanking the people who took the time to send me an email or to make a comment on the program. And secondly, as you know, at least in the early stages of our time together, where I can give due credit and due attention to the emails and to the comments. The first item or issue that I would like to address is the issue of the consideration the issue we focused on Monday, which was on the whole nature of the commons. And one of the suggestions, very glad that to hear that some of you who are tuned in did this. There's probably the best article on the whole idea of the commons and its history and its relevance today is a document, an article written in 2002, just about 10 years ago, by David Bowler in the Boston Digest. David Bowler, B-O-L-L-E-R. It's on the commons. It talks about the background, where the idea of the commons came from, some of the historical background, how, as we evolve into the 21st century, the nature of the commons is changing. It doesn't, and this I think is very significant, it doesn't become any less important than it ever was before, even though it receives a lot less attention than it ever did before historically. And I think David Bowler is right on the mark when he makes the comment that part of what makes the whole idea of the commons a little bit unfamiliar is that over the last half century or so, we as a nation were so obsessed with the idea of communism The threat of international communism and the Cold War and all that was associated with it, the wars, the Vietnams, the Koreas, and all of these, that anything that smacked of communism, which was like cooperative ownership or cooperative responsibility or joint management or anything like that, it almost becomes an issue of any word that begins with the word C-O-M-M is suspect. And the fact of the matter is that obsession with communism and that concern about it pretty much pushed the idea of a commons, the idea of a common ownership, the fact that the people of a society own something together, which part of the responsibility of their government is to manage in their best interests, in their public interest. That's something that was very, very uncomfortable for many of us during the height of the Cold War. And so consequently, the commons was kind of pushed into the background. The whole idea pretty much disappeared from our regular discussions in the minds of many people. And what David Bowler's article did in 1902 is bring that issue back to the fore. It's one of the best pieces that I've ever read. And I mentioned the fact that I received a more than one. I received a couple of comments about the idea of the commons. And it prompted me to do something. And I wanted to share this with you just briefly. And I don't want to go back into the comments today. I want to spend most of today on James Madison's Federalist Number 10. But it occurred to me that there's a letter from Thomas Jefferson related to the commons that I think is very, very appropriate at this time. So I went through my notes, and I came to the letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to Peter Pope in the year 1787. And this is Jefferson talking about man's priority as being a member of society. The whole idea going all the way back to Aristotle that man is a social animal as well as a political animal. And what that means is that man was not intended to live alone, but rather he lives in communities and societies and all the rest of it. We talked about that in our first few programs together. But I think what makes Thomas Jefferson's point of view interesting in this is that Thomas Jefferson is the author of the Declaration of Independence, the principal author, obviously, we know that. And as such, Thomas Jefferson is given priority credit in our history for the idea of articulating man's natural rights to life, liberty, and property. And of course, in today's world, conservatives focus on that emphasis, which comes from Locke and from Locke's State of Nature through Jefferson. The idea that man's freedom, man's right to property, are priorities in our society, and protection of that freedom and of that right to property is, in the eyes of Locke and in the thinking of Jefferson, the principal ingredient of the principal reason for man's creation of government in the first place. So the fact that Jefferson is the author of that makes the following quotation from the letter that he wrote to his friend Peter Carr in 1787 particularly interesting. Jefferson says the following: man was destined for society. His morality, therefore, was to be formed to this object. He was endowed with the sense of right and wrong merely relative to this. This sense is as much a part of his nature as the sense of hearing, seeing, feeling. It is the true foundation of morality. The moral sense, or conscience, is as much a part of man as his leg or his arm. It is given to all human beings in a stronger or weaker degree. It may be strengthened by exercise, as may any particular limb of the body. This sense is submitted indeed in some degree to the guidance of reason. It is a small stock which is required for this, even a less one than we call common sense. state a moral case to a plowman and a professor. The former will decide it as well, and often better than the latter, because he has not been led astray by artificial rules. What a statement. I think it's worth looking at in a little bit of detail, especially since we did spend so much time talking about the idea of the commons. Jefferson says again, man was destined for society. His morality, therefore, was to be formed to this object. In other words, man's morality, everything related to it, is connected to the idea that man was intended to live in society, which means he was intended to live with and interact with other people. He was endowed with a sense of right and wrong, merely relative to this. Jefferson is suggesting that our whole concept of right and wrong is tied directly to man's role as a social animal, man's role within community, not as a free operating individual within the state of nature, but a man that has certain obligations and responsibilities to the people around him. This sense, Jefferson said, is as much a part of his nature as the sense of hearing, seeing, feeling. It is the true foundation of morality. That's pretty powerful. Jefferson goes on and says, the moral sense, or conscience, is as much a part of man as his leg or his arm. It is given to all human beings in a stronger or weaker degree. In other words, some people are more moral than others. Some need morality strengthened. Some people are endowed with a strong sense of morality. But Jefferson said, it, meaning that sense of morality, may be strengthened by exercise, as may any particular limb of the body. In other words, just as you can lift weights to strengthen your arms, or you can do squats to strengthen your leg muscles, or you can jog or run in order to strengthen your heart, so also can you perform exercise that will strengthen your morality. In other words, you are not condemned to live with a particular level of morality that you have currently. It can be strengthened. You can be made, or you can be taught to be more moral than you are now. And I go back to Jefferson's idea of education, of universal education, and part of that initial stage where everybody goes to school for the required 3 years of basic education, Jefferson said it is at that level where the seeds of morality are planted. That's where morality is developed, Jefferson says, and that's his belief in the idea that morality can be strengthened, can be honed, can be exercised. This sense, he says, is submitted indeed in some degree to the guidance of reason. Common sense makes us understand how important morality is, of course. In other words, common sense or reason guides it. But it is a small stock which is required for this, even a less one than we call common sense. And what he's suggesting is that man's morality, man's sense of responsibility to his neighbors, to others, is ingrained within him. It can be learned, it can be strengthened, but it's there in all of us because man is a social animal, Jefferson says. State a moral case. State an issue of morality to a plowman and a professor. Think about the difference. Jefferson is implying that the plowman, the farmer, is probably uneducated, unsophisticated in the nuances of reason and analysis, and probably is not well read, is what Jefferson is implying here. But on the other hand, make the same moral case to a professor, somebody whose life is focused on the idea of reason and thinking and common sense and all the rest of it. The former, the plowman, will decide it as well, and often better than will the professor. because he's not been led astray by artificial rules. Jefferson is saying something here that I think is incredibly important, namely that oftentimes what our gut tells us in moral matters, in issues related to right and wrong and morality, is oftentimes closer or more on target than is what we reason or what we fathom or what we come to as a result of cognitive exercise or analysis. Because reason can lead us astray as well, but Jefferson is implying that the morality planted within us is never going to do that. So Jefferson is suggesting that our sense of right and wrong, of conscience, of morality, is ingrained within all of us. It's there. We have a responsibility to cultivate it, and it can be improved. But the fact of the matter is, it's there. And oftentimes, Jefferson says, we're in better shape if we trust it rather than our reason, because that can be led astray, he says, by artificial rules. Morality is never going to fail us. I also think that Jeff's focus here on the idea of society, on the idea of community, and man's relationship to everybody else in it, is very important, because it's the idea, even though Jefferson is the author of the Declaration, even though Jefferson is the person who put pen to paper and articulated the idea of inalienable rights to life, liberty, and property, which people focus on so incredibly often today, people tend to overlook the fact that Jefferson believed in the idea of a commons. He believed in the idea of community and the importance of community, and the idea that government had a responsibility to people in community. So I think that this is a very, very important statement from Jefferson. It's something that all of us need to be aware of. And I think, you know, in an introductory paragraph in a book that I'm working on, I made the statement that Jefferson is kind of the fly in the conservative ointment today, because of all people to put an emphasis on community responsibility and our sense of morality and obligations one to another. Jefferson is the most difficult one to deal with, because he's the author of the Declaration of Independence, which is the focus of many of those conservative folks today who focus on the idea of the sanctity of private property and the limitations on the power of government and all the rest of it. I think it's very, very significant, the relationship that Jefferson makes between morality and the extent to which it is ingrained, it is natural, it is part of man's nature. And it basically speaks volumes about man's responsibilities one to another, to each other, to the community as a whole. I think there's a tendency, as I mentioned the other day, and I just wanted to repeat again before we get off this, I think there's a tendency to downplay or to de-emphasize the extent to which the founders were aware of, conscious of, and very considerate of the importance of community, the importance of responsibility one to another. And I think, as we touched upon in our earlier programs, the extent to which the founders linked or connected the idea of civic virtue, the idea of virtue, to the success of a republic, a republican form of government, is incredibly important to never forget. They really believed that this was vital. And Jefferson's idea of universal education, Benjamin Rush's idea of universal education, all of these people accepted the fact that the success of a popular government, the success of republicanism, hinged to a tremendous degree on the idea of virtue and morality and one's sense of reason and common sense and fairness and willingness to put the public interest ahead of their own private interests. In fact, there's no question that it's that kind of idealism which seems to be so in vogue in 1776, the idealism surrounding Jefferson and surrounding the Declaration and surrounding John Adams is probably a person that is more fired, if you will, in 1776 by the idealism and the tremendous sense of optimism and positivism that he associates with independence. It's all tied to the idea of civic virtue and responsibility and the tremendous opportunity that republican government brings to the people of this country, which is so different than any other society that exists at that point in time. It's refreshing, it's exciting, and it's encouraging. And that's why it seems to me, to make the transition back to Madison's Federalist Number 10, that's why the transition from that optimism into the problems of the Confederation is so significant. That's why people like John Fisk, going back to yesterday's program for a second, that's why people like John Fisk labeled the Confederation period the critical period. Because all that was possible as a result of independence to John Fisk seemed to be at risk during the Confederation. Because much of the realism, much of the optimism, much of the positive that came out of was being lost in the Confederation during the Confederation period because of the realities of what living independently of the British Empire was causing to happen, what the independence of the states was bringing about. And that caused Madison to put down his vices of the political system, where he articulated one after some problems, some of the ways that we were overly optimistic and overly too idealistic in 1776, and we had to make some serious reforms. And the Constitution of the United States becomes that reform. And Madison's Federalist Number 10 is his effort to try to explain how the Constitution is going to salvage the idea of Republican government, of Republican transition. With the Constitution, there is a tremendous shift in that process. And so that's kind of where we were yesterday as we started to look at Madison's Federalist Number 10. And I'd like to return to it. I'd like to do it in a way by making reference to yet another an email that I received from a listener based on yesterday's program, and I wanted to share it with you because I think it's a good way to get back into Madison's Federalist Number 10. The person who emailed made the comment that that I was probably dating myself, and of course I am more than willing to admit that. I've been in education for a lot of years, and there's no question that I'm a product of those years. One has to conclude that one's experiences are positive, but they oftentimes may not always be, because sometimes you get locked into the way things used to be and you tend to overlook change. But anyway, I made the comment, we were looking at Federalist Number 10 yesterday, that one of the negatives that I see in our education system is that while we focus incredibly on teaching students to read, for the most part, we tend to teach them to read at a very elementary level, which focuses on words rather than comprehension. And I made that point, that we don't seem to be doing as much with reading comprehension as we need to. And the person who emailed me, the emailer made the comment, and said, you know, that from her experience in classrooms, we do tend to focus on meaning, on the meaning of information as well as just reading the words. And that I may be, that may have been something from an earlier period, but more and more attention is being given today on the issue of reading comprehension. And I take that I take that comment for what it's worth. I think it's an important one, and I hope that it's true. The only thing that I can go by is the number of years that I've been teaching at the college level, which is approaching 50. And over the course of those many years, I've been spending an awful lot of time on Federalist Number 10 over the years, because in government classes I teach, in American history classes I teach, I feel that this this document is incredibly important in explaining the essence of how our political system is supposed to work from the person who designed it. And that's why I think it's particularly important, as I mentioned before. And one of the things I've found over the years, and it hasn't changed, is that few students that I've encountered at the college level can handle Federalist Number 10. They find it very, very difficult to read. And these are college students. They are, you know, not randomly, students randomly selected from our general population. They are college students who have been admitted to a college with admission standards. In other words, there's a screening process. And theoretically, I want to have to assume that most of the students who come to the college and university level have demonstrated a comfort level with reading and reading comprehension that is above average. And I accept that. But what I have found is that Federalist Number 10, unfailingly, I have found that Federalist Number 10 tests that level of ability, that ability to comprehend what he is writing. Now, again, Madison's Federalist Number 10, Madison writes well. He writes on a level which makes it very difficult. On the other hand, I am absolutely overwhelmed, consumed with Otto's, Ambassador Otto's comments in 1786 back to Vergennes in France, which suggests that our public documents in American politics are being written at that time on different levels. On one level, the best people, those that Madison calls in Federalist Number 10, the most considerate and virtuous citizens, the best people, can understand perfectly what these documents are saying. But the average person, as Otto says, understands them with great difficulty. And that, Otto suggests, is not unintentional. It's not a failing in the education system that the many have been exposed to, so much as it is a conscious effort to basically talk to one group of people without making clear to the other group of people what the message, what the content is. I think that, and I think Federalist Number 10 is a best example of this, I think that we are experiencing a level of writing here which is intentionally designed to be over the heads of many people who might read this. But at the same time, it is intended to inform and to reassure the most considerate and virtuous citizens that the Constitution of the United States will indeed address many of the problems that causes them to support the need for reform of the Confederation in 1787. Many of those people who understand and are worried about the vices that Madison lists in his Vices of the Political System of the United States are going to find consolation and reassurance in Madison's Federalist Number 10, while the average people are probably not going to be able to quite understand what he's talking about. It's written on two levels. And I think basically what I have found over the years is that in order for students to really understand this document, it is absolutely vital that we get into the document to the point that students read it at a level above the level that they are accustomed to read history or literature or anything else. So with that introduction, we have reached the bottom of our first hour together today. And let me again, as it occurs to me, make you aware of the phone number, and we would love to hear from you. If you call area code 304-658-3333, you will be into the studios, and we'll get you directly on the air, and we can talk about this. Again, that's area code 304-658-3333. We didn't get that far into Madison's Federalist Number 10 yesterday, so let's kind of review where we were very quickly. And to do that, I'm going to read Madison in his own words. Among the numerous advantages promised by a well-constructed union, Madison says, none deserves to be more accurately developed than its tendency to break and control the violence of faction. We talked about faction. We talked about the use of the term violence. And we talked about the fact that we are looking at those people who recognize the need for political reform, the advantages promised by a well-constructed union. The implication is that we don't have that currently. The friend of popular governments, Madison says, never finds himself so much alarmed for their character and their fate as when he contemplates their propensity to this dangerous vice. Popular governments have always suffered, Madison is saying, from their tendency toward this dangerous vice, which is the violence of faction. He, the friend of popular government, he will not fail, therefore, to set a due value on any plan which, without violating the principles to which he's attached, provides a proper cure for it. The friend of popular government, therefore, because he recognizes the problems, will give serious attention to any plan which promises to cure the danger of the violence of faction without violating the principles of popular government to which the friend of popular government obviously is committed. The instability, injustice, and confusion introduced into the public councils, and of course Madison outlines those for us in his Vices of the Political System, have in truth been the mortal diseases under which popular governments have everywhere perished. Popular governments have always failed because of their inclination toward instability, injustice, and confusion in government. Therefore, popular governments have never made it. As they continue to be the favorite and fruitful topics from which the adversaries to liberty derive their most specious declamations. So, in a sense, popular governments continue to be the favorite topics of demagogues, those who want to whip up the people against the existing government or existing regime and suggest to them that popular government promises something better. And so history has been full of demagogues who always go in that direction in order to whip up popular support. And if you remember from Madison's Vices, one of the major concerns he has are those people, even though they are a minority, who will whip up the masses, who will whip up those who may not be able to vote, but in a sense, they create a numerical majority, even though the ideas are coming from a small group. And then Madison makes the point that this is especially true in the society of the United States. Valuable improvements made by the American constitutions on the popular models, both ancient and modern, cannot certainly be too much of a Madison says. We've come a long way in our constitutions. But it would be an unwarrantable partiality to contend that they have as effectually obviated the danger on this side as was wished and expected. It would be naive for us to assume that the problems inherent in popular governments have as yet been solved. Complaints are everywhere heard from our most considerate and virtuous citizens, Madison says. Equally, the friends of public and private faith, which relates to debts, and public and personal liberty, which relates to property. That our governments are too unstable, that the public good is disregarded in the conflicts of rival parties, and that measures are too often decided not according to the rules of justice and the rights of the minor party, but by the superior force of an interested and overbearing majority. Madison is saying in this sentence that the best people, the most considerate and virtuous citizens, who support the idea of paying your obligations both to government and taxes and to creditors in the form of private debt, and who believe in the idea of personal liberty and the right to own property and have it protected, these best people are complaining that our governments are too unstable and that the public good is often disregarded in the conflicts between factions, between rival parties, and that too often measures are decided, laws are passed, policies are decided, not according to what's just and the rights of the minority, protecting the rights of the minority, but by the superior force of an interested and overbearing majority. Majorities are calling the shots in our states under the Confederation, Madison says, and it is worrying our best people, our most considerate and virtuous citizens, who are, I would point out, the minority. However anxiously we may wish that these complaints had no foundation, Madison says, the evidence of known facts will not permit us to deny that they are in some degree true. Wish it wasn't true, but it would be naive for us not to acknowledge that indeed they are true. It will be found indeed on a candid view of our situation that some of the distresses under which we labor have been erroneously charged in the operation of our governments. If we really seriously look at the situation, we would have to admit that some of our problems are erroneously blamed on government itself. But it will be found, he says, at the same time, that other causes will not alone account for many of our heaviest misfortunes, and particularly for that prevailing and increasing distrust of public engagements and alarm for private rights, which are echoed from one end of the continent to the other. So Madison is laying the issues right squarely on the table. These must be chiefly, if not wholly, effects of the unsteadiness and injustice with which a factious spirit has tainted our public administrations. Madison said, bottom line, forget structure of government and all the rest of it, bottom line, the factious rivalries, the factions that exist within our state governments, and the opportunities for majorities to rule at the expense of minorities, at the expense of what's right, putting self-interest ahead of public interest, more than anything else, Madison says, these are really the problems that taint our public administrations, our governments. So Madison has laid out exactly what the problems are under the Confederation. But he's done it in a very abstract way. He hasn't gone into specifics, but the people to whom he's concerned about the most, the people to whom he's speaking, understand those specifics. They've read the vices of the political system in which he lays out the details. There are no details in this article. The general population who reads this in the newspaper is not going to know the specifics that Madison has laid out in his vices. But the most considerate and virtuous citizens will know. He is speaking to them exactly in language they want to hear. But to those of us, to those of the general population who would be reading this in the press, even if they could read it, it's written in a very abstract way, because he's talking about violence, he's talking about dishonesty, he's talking about injustice, he's talking about violence. He's using all the buzzwords that would frighten people who have no, that, for whom there is no depth beyond the words themselves. And so naturally, people who are reading this saying, oh, whatever he proposes, we got to fix this. These kinds of conditions aren't good, without really understanding the details of what those conditions are. Madison, at this point, goes back to his opening sentence about the violence of faction and a well-constructed union promising to break and control the violence of faction. Madison says, he defines a faction. He said, by a faction, I understand a number of citizens, whether amounting to a majority or a minority of the whole, who are united and actuated by some common impulse of passion or of interest, adverse to the rights of other citizens or to the permanent and aggregate interests of the community. Madison is defining a faction as what we call today an interest group. A group of citizens, a group of people who organize for their own self-interest by finding people who have the same self-interest that they do. And Madison said, this can either be a majority or a minority of the whole. Very important here to pause and think for a second. What would be the common factor, the common element of self-interest that would unite the majority? Madison said that a faction can be a minority, those who are interested in property or debts or credit or money owed them or availability of land or whatever. It's easy to understand the self-interest that would unite a minority. But what would be the self-interest that would unite the majority? I just raised that question. I don't answer it at this point. But he is suggesting that there can be self-interest that unites a majority as well as a minority. And the question is, it's easier to understand what would unite a minority. It's a little bit more difficult to understand what would unite a majority. It's a little bit more abstract, because the reality is that the majority are the poor. And so what is the self-interest that unites the poor other than their poverty itself? Okay. Madison says then that that a faction can be a majority or a minority, but it is a group that is united and actuated by some common impulse of passion that is adverse to the rights of other citizens or to the permanent and aggregate interests of the community. It's self-interest taking priority over public interest, however many are contained, are included in the group. So that's the faction. Madison said there are two methods of curing the mischiefs of faction. One, by removing its causes. The other, by controlling its effects. So if factions are a problem, then Madison says there are two ways to cure the mischief of factions. One is to take away the causes of them. In other words, create the kind of circumstances or the kind of environment where there'll be no need for factions. The other way to cure the mischiefs of factions is to control their effects, even if they do organize, make it difficult for them to operate. Madison goes on and says there are, again, two methods of removing the causes of faction. So remember, he said there are two ways to cure the mischiefs. One is to remove the causes. The other way is to control the effects. Now he's focusing on the first one, which is the causes. And he said there are, again, two methods of removing the causes of faction. One, by destroying the liberty which is essential to its existence. The other, by giving to every citizen the same opinions, the same passions, and the same interests. So the two ways to remove the causes of faction are, first, destroying the liberty essential to its existence. In other words, take away people's freedom to belong to factions. Eliminate freedom, and you've eliminated the problems of faction. That's one way. The other way that you could go at it, Madison says, is to give every citizen the same passions, the same opinions, the same interests. In other words, make everybody the same. If everybody's the same, then there's no need for factions. Those are the two ways that you, according to Madison, that you can get rid of factions, remove the causes of faction. Now Madison's going to address each of those remedies. He says, it could never be more truly said than of the first remedy, taking away people's freedom, that it was worse than the disease. Liberty is to faction what air is to fire, an ailment without which it instantly expires. But it could not be less folly to abolish liberty, which is essential to political life, because it nourishes faction, than it would be to wish the annihilation of air, which is essential to animal life, because it imparts to fire its destructive agency. Again, don't ignore the language, the way this is written. It's written in a very abstract narrative. Madison says, to take away people's freedoms to belong to factions is a cure worse than the disease. And his analogy is, liberty is as necessary to faction as air is to fire. But he said it would be as foolish to take away people's freedom, which is absolutely essential to political life in our society, in a republic, as it would be to wish the annihilation of air, which is essential to human life, which is essential to all animal life, because air imparts to fire its destructive agency. Because fire can cause harm, a way to eliminate fire is to annihilate air. But that would be a cure worse than the disease. So also, Madison is saying, would a cure worse than the disease be the annihilation of freedom, because freedom causes faction? So what he's effectively done is eliminating the first cure. Remember, he said there's two ways to cure, to remove the causes of faction. One is to destroy freedom. Now he's eliminated that option. Now he's going to the second one, which is the idea of giving everybody the same opinions, the same passions, and the same interests. Now he addresses that, and he says, the second expedient is as impractical as it is as impracticable as the first would be unwise. As long as the reason of man continues fallible, and he is at liberty to exercise it, different opinions will be formed. So basically what he's saying is, to make everybody the same is not reasonable. It's not logical. It's impossible. As long as reason continues fallible, Madison says. In other words, as long as man has a mind, as long as man can think and reason, and he's free to exercise it, he's at liberty to exercise it, different opinions will be formed. As long as man is free to think and has a mind, he's going to reach conclusions which differ from the conclusions reached by other people. So, in a sense, Madison is denying John Locke's state of nature here. Madison is denying Locke's assumption that reason is what makes the state of nature relatively stable and secure. Locke believed in the state of nature that because man had reason, that meant that everybody would understand the law of nature, which is to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And Locke believed that that fact would guarantee, for the most part, order and stability in nature. Madison is rejecting that. Madison is rejecting the idea that man's nature is going to allow his concern for others to take precedence over his own self-interest. Madison is saying, as long as man has reason, and as long as he's free to exercise that reason, different opinions are going to be formed. As long as the connection subsists, Madison said, between his reason and his self-love, his opinions and his passions will have a reciprocal influence on each other, and the former will be objects to which the latter will attach themselves. Tell me that that is not written at a level that is very difficult to understand. Talk about the nature of language as revealed in this document. Again, let me read that sentence. As long as the connection subsists between his reason and his self-love, his opinions and his passions will have a reciprocal influence on each other, and the former, his opinions and his passions, will be the objects to which the latter will attach themselves. As long as man has a mind, and as long as he's free to use that mind, and as long as he's able to reason and think through the ways that he's going to be able to satisfy his own opinions and his own passions, the result will be that these will have a reciprocal influence on each other. Man's reason and his passions will connect, and he will see the opportunities available to satisfy. Madison says the diversity in the faculties of men, men's faculties, their abilities, their intelligence, their ability to reason and think and think logically, the diversity in the faculties of men from which the rights of property originate is not less an insuperable obstacle to a uniformity of interests. Think about that. Of all the examples Madison could use about the connection between reason and self-interest, Madison says the diversity in the faculties of men from which the rights of property originate is not less an insuperable obstacle to a uniformity of interests. As long as man is free, as long as he can reason, as long as he can figure out ways to satisfy his own self-interest, and as long as he is free to unite with other people who have the same self-interest as he does, the result is going to be a faction, an interest group. There's no way to prevent it, Madison said. You can't make everybody the same. And the example that he gives is property. If people are free and people have different abilities, then they're going to end up with different amounts of property. Some people are going to be rich and some people are going to be poor, Madison says. That means that if man is free, then you can never have a uniformity of opinions and interests. And then Madison says, in one of the most important sentences in this document, the protection of these faculties is the first object of government. The protection of man's faculties to be free and to pursue his own self-interest, property, Madison says, the protection of these faculties is the first object of government. Government's primary responsibility is to protect people's freedom to pursue property to their own abilities and talents and have it protected. Madison goes on, from the protection of different and unequal faculties of acquiring property, the possession of different degrees and kinds of property immediately results. And from the influence of these on the sentiments and views of the respective proprietors ensues a division of society into different interests and parties. What I would suggest, as we move towards the top of our first hour, what I would suggest is that what Madison is suggesting here is that of all the interests and opinions and self-interest that man has, Madison is assuming that most of these will tend to coalesce around property, that in this society, the pursuit of property, wealth, is the number one value of being free. That's what liberty is about, is freedom to pursue property and to have it protected. And for that, Madison said, that's what government was created for. That's Locke. That's exactly what Locke said man came out of the state of nature to do, was to protect his natural rights to life, liberty, and property. So Madison and Locke are in tandem there. They're in total agreement there. And then Madison says that from the protection of unequal, of different and unequal faculties of acquiring property, because some people have different faculties. Some people are intelligent, they're bright, they're inventive, they're lucky, they are connected, they have the right connections, they come from the right families, they went to the right schools, they made the right contacts, they network effectively, all the terms that we use today in business in today's world. The result would be that because man has different faculties of acquiring property, the result is going to be the possession of different degrees and kinds of property. Some people are going to be extremely successful, some people are going to be moderately successful, and some people are not going to be successful at all. And from the influence of these on the sentiments and views of the respective proprietors ensues a division of society into different interests and parties. In other words, the major issue that creates competing interests and parties and factions in society revolve around property, around success, around wealth, around government's responsibility to protect that wealth. What Madison is suggesting then, he opens, this is analysis here, I'm going back a little bit without rereading. Madison opens by talking about the violence of factions. And he implies that they're very bad. Now what he's saying is you can't take away people's freedom. That would be a cure worse than the disease. But Madison says as long as man has a mind, as long as he can think, and as long as he can reason, and as long as he's free to unite with other people, have the same interests he does, the result is going to be the acquisition of different amounts of property and the expectation that his freedom to acquire that property and have it protected will be government's first object, the first object of government. That's government's priority. So in a sense, what Madison is suggesting, and I'm going to conclude the top of our hour here with this comment, because I think it's telling. I want you to reflect on this for a few minutes, if you will. What Madison is suggesting then is that a major cause of factions is this issue revolving around the pursuit of property and the different amounts and kinds of property that people acquire. Now remember, Madison has said that a faction can be either a majority or a minority of the whole. If the principal reason for factions revolves around property, then the reality is that the minority faction are the ones with the property, and the majority faction is the one without it. So in a sense, what Madison is saying to me, this is interpretive now, this is my analysis of this document. What I hear Madison saying is the major divisions in society revolve around the unequal distribution of property. And because man is free to pursue his self-interest and to unite with other people and to create factions, government's number one object is to protect people's freedom to acquire and have their properties secure. But if the major cause of factions is property, and the faction can either be a majority or a minority, then what Madison is saying is the major factional challenge, the major issue in society that presents the greatest challenge to government, is the difference between the rich and the poor. The difference between those who have property and are successful and those who do not have property and are not. That potentially is the major disruptive force in society, and that becomes government's major management challenge, is to manage that difference. Let's pause for 4 or 5 minutes at the top of our first hour and hopefully give people a chance to reflect on that a minute, and we'll be back. This is Bill O'Brien. Thank you for being with us. We'll be right back.
She was the pride of the Canada line, the Empress of Ireland, sailing upon the cold North Tide, crossing the wild ocean. It crossing 4 days, 200 trips made, in the service of many she'd been. The great ship went down, 1,000 souls drowned, on the Empress of Ireland. Friends had strolled upon her deck, lost in her ballroom grand. While sleeping they drowned when the Empress went down, only 5 miles from land. The Empress of Ireland. Late in the spring, 1914, she met a terrible end. She had the same crew, but the captain was new when she set sail again. He saw a light from the ship on that night, before the fog settled in. They heard her horn sound as the ship ran her down, the Empress of Ireland. Friends had strolled upon her deck, waltzed in her ballroom grand. While sleeping they drowned, the Empress went down, only 5 miles from land. The Empress of Ireland. In minutes all gone, sunk like a stone, in a watery grave settled down. Still resting they lie in the beds where they died, on the Empress of Ireland. With lifeboats they found, 400 not drowned, and the Salvation Army band. 1,000 souls drowned when the Empress went down, only 5 miles from land. Empress of Ireland. Friends had strolled upon her deck, waltzed in her ballroom grand. While sleeping they drowned when the Empress went down, only 5 miles from land. The Empress of Ireland.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
This is Bill O'Brien back with you. We're at the beginning of our second hour on today's version of the Virtual Center for the Study of the U.S. Constitution. I'm Bill O'Brien. I invite you to give us a call and chat online, not only for your own benefit and mine, but for the benefit of other people who are tuned in as well. The phone number, area code 304-658-3333. Again, that's area code 304-658-3333. And again, my email address for those of you who would like to contact me directly, waobrien906@gmail.com. That's waobrien906, all one word, @gmail.com. We've have spent the better part of our first hour looking at Madison's Federalist Number 10. We are well into it. I think, again, the meaning that exists within this document, between the lines, so to speak, the potential for analysis here, for putting the pieces together, are opportunities to draw meaning out of this document are absolutely incredible. But I would point to you that all of it remains at a level which we would have to say is abstract. There are very few specifics here, specific examples of what he's talking about. The examples of what he's talking about are in the Vices document that we looked at on Monday. With that kind of background, the abstractions of Federalist Number 10 become a little bit less evasive. They become a little bit easier to see and to handle. And so I think that is very significant. What Madison has, the point of analysis that Madison has reached so far, is that there are two ways to control the violence of a faction, Madison said. The first one is to remove the causes of faction. The second one is to control the effects of faction. He deals with the removing the causes first. In other words, he addresses the first solution first. And he said, if you're going to eliminate the causes, there are two ways to do it. One is to destroy people's freedom to belong to them. The other is to make everybody the same by giving every citizen the same passions, the same interests, the same opinions. Madison has then explained to us that eliminating people's freedom is a cure worse than the disease. And he uses the analogy of air and fire to make that point. In other words, and this becomes extremely important to those, to conservative folks who read Madison, Madison is putting a premium on individual freedom. He's put a premium here on the pursuit of property and self-interest. And so all of those who want to see in the founders the beginnings of a free enterprise system where man's rights to life, liberty, and property without government interference are priority items, focus very, very heavily on this aspect of Madison's Federalist Number 10. So you can't take away man's freedom, he says. So that eliminates one of the ways that you can eliminate the causes. The other way is to give everybody the same interests, passions, and opinions. Make everybody the same. And Madison says that's impossible as well, because he said that would be as impracticable as the first way, the elimination of freedom would be unwise. And then he points out that factions are natural. As long as man's reason continues fallible, as long as man is free to exercise that reason, as long as man is free to unite with other people who have the same interests and passions that he does, the result is going to be factions, interest groups, different groups of people who organize for their own self-interest. Madison says that's natural. You can't do anything about that. And then he uses the pursuit of property as being the key example of the origin of these factions. The diversity in the faculties of men from which the rights of property originate is not less an insuperable object to a uniformity of interest. Free people are going to pursue their own self-interest, their own wealth, their own level of success, their own property. That alone, he says, is a major obstacle to try to create a uniformity of interests. And the protection of these faculties, the protection of man's freedom to pursue property and his right to have it protected, is the first object of government, Madison says. He's right in tune there with Locke and with Jefferson's Declaration. So Madison goes on and reaches some conclusions. And he says, the latent causes of faction are thus sown in the nature of man. And we see them everywhere brought into different degrees of activity according to the different circumstances of civil society. Factions are natural. You can't make everybody the same because factions are part of human nature. It's what we must live with if man is to be free. And man has said we cannot tamper with man's freedom. So free people will join factions. There's no way to avoid it, Madison said. The causes of faction are sown in the nature of man. And he says we see them brought into different degrees of activity according to the different circumstances in civil society. And now he's going to go through and give us some examples. He says a zeal for different opinions concerning religion, concerning government, and many other points, as well as speculation as of practice, an achievement to different leaders, an attachment to different leaders ambitiously contending for preeminence and power, or to the persons of other descriptions whose fortunes have been interesting to the human passions, have in turn divided mankind into parties, inflamed them with mutual animosity, and rendered them much more disposed to vex and oppress each other than to cooperate for their common good. What Madison is doing in a rather general way is going through what he was much more specific about in his Vices of the Political System. He's saying people have different opinions about religion. They'll have different opinions about government. They'll differ on many other points. As well speculation as well as practice. They'll support different political leaders who are contending for preeminence and power. They'll be in different parties. Or they'll align themselves with people who seem to have the same interests as they do. And he said, these differences have in turn divided mankind into parties, have inflamed them with mutual animosity, and have rendered them much more disposed to vex and oppress each other than to cooperate for the common good. So it is naive to believe that man is going to put self-interest aside in favor of the public interest. Madison is denying the reality, the possibility of civic virtue as being the key ingredient in making Republican government work. Madison is challenging the optimism of 1776. Madison is challenging Jefferson. He's challenging John Adams. He's challenged the opposite, the idea that you can make man moral and teach man the importance of the golden rule of putting public interest ahead of private interest. Madison is saying that free people naturally form factions. And that means that they will always look out for their own self-interest, and it'll be rare that they will be able to cooperate for their own common good. We are dealing with human nature, which is self-interested, which is greedy, which has a mind. In other words, man has reason and man is free. That combination is going to produce factions. It's always going to overwhelm a concern for the public interest. Virtue is never going to prevail in this kind of a system, Madison is saying. He goes on. So strong is this propensity of mankind to fall into mutual animosities that where no substantial occasion presents itself, the most frivolous and fanciful distinctions have been sufficient to kindle their unfriendly passions and excite their most violent conflicts. Madison says, even when the differences which cause factions, major ones, don't exist, man seems inclined to find minor factions. Who went to different high schools? Who went to different clubs? Whatever. You know, who lives in which neighborhoods? People find the most fanciful and frivolous reasons to disagree and form factions, Madison says. And then he lays the law down in what I think is the most important line in this document. Madison said, but the most common and durable source of factions has been the various and unequal distribution of property. Those who hold and those who are without property have ever formed distinct interests in society. Those who are creditors and those who are debtors fall under like discrimination. A landed interest, a manufacturing interest, a mercantile interest, a moneyed interest, with many lesser interests, grow up of necessity in civilized nations and divide them into different classes actuated by different sentiments and views. The regulation of these various and interfering interests forms the principal task of modern legislation and involves the spirit of party and faction in the necessary and ordinary operations of the government. Wow. Think about that, what Madison is saying. He says man naturally forms factions. They're sown into the nature of man. You can't do anything about it. They will disagree on all sorts of things. Where they can't find major things, they'll find frivolous and fanciful things to disagree about. But then he comes back to the issue of property. And he said the most common and durable source of factions has always been, throughout history, the various and unequal distribution of property. Of all the things that divide men in societies throughout the history of the world, the various and unequal distribution of property. Those who hold it and those who are without it, those who hold property and those who are without property, have ever formed distinct interests in society. Again, he's going back to this idea of the rich and the poor. And he says, there are creditors and there are debtors. That's the same difference. Then he goes into different kinds of property, a landed interest, a manufacturing interest, a mercantile interest, a moneyed interest, and many lesser interests grow up of necessity in civilized society and divide them into different classes. And then he said, the regulation of these various and interfering interests to manage these factions forms the principal task of modern legislation. This is what government's major job is to manage this. And it involves the spirit of party and faction in the necessary and ordinary operations of government. We can't do anything about it. It's what we've got. We need to find a way to deal with this. I want to stop a second. because I can't help it. We need to go back to Madison's beginning here in Federalist Number 10, where he says factions can either be a majority or a minority. Now he's saying that the major cause of factions throughout history has been the various and unequal distribution of property between those who have it and those who don't, between the rich and the poor. That's always been the major cause of factions, and managing that difference is the principal challenge of government. Madison has said that a faction can either be a majority or a minority of the whole. If the major cause of factions is the unequal distribution of property, then obviously the majority faction is the poor, and the minority faction are the property. And so while Madison makes a distinction between a landed interest, a moneyed interest, a manufacturing interest, a mercantile interest, in other words, he's making a difference between, he's talking about investors, he's talking about farmers, he's talking about merchants, he's talking about businessmen, he's talking about all different kinds of people and different kinds of, potentially different kinds of property. The one thing they all have in common is that they are property owners faced with the biggest threat of all, which is the majority faction, those who don't have any property at all. So while Madison is suggesting that landed interests, manufacturing interests, mercantile interests, and moneyed interests compete with each other as factions, when the threat becomes the majority faction, the poor, they all unite. They have to, because they all have something more to lose to win. In other words, the only way that they can prevail in their own private interest is to basically deal effectively with the most dangerous interest of all, which is the threat of the majority faction. If factions are natural, then not only are the organizations of property owners natural, so also is the danger of the poor uniting, the majority faction. That becomes the major issue, the major threat, I would suggest to you, to Madison. That becomes, I believe, over and above everything else, the driving force behind the Constitution of the United States, is to manage that, is to manage that difference. I think this is unbelievably important. Absolutely unbelievable. It is so important. Madison continues and says, no man is allowed to be a judge in his own cause, because his interest would certainly bias his judgment and not improbably corrupt his integrity. And that makes perfect sense. I think everybody can agree with that. You can't be a judge in your own case when you're a party to it. With equal, nay, with greater reason, a body of men are unfit to be both judges and parties at the same time. Yet what are many of the most important acts of legislation, but so many judicial determinations, not indeed concerning the rights of single persons, but concerning the rights of large bodies of citizens? Our governments under the Confederation, our republics, are susceptible to majority rule. And what we, when we have the majority making the rules, we are allowing people to make policy driven by their own self-interests. You cannot have the judges making decisions when the decisions affect them directly. And so by having the majority make the law, you are allowing the majority to satisfy their own self-interests at the expense of the public interest, at the expense of minority interests. Madison says, with equal, nay, with greater reason, a body of men are unfit to be both judges and parties at the same time. Yet what are many of the most important acts of legislation, again, 1780s, but so many judicial determinations, not indeed concerning the rights of single persons, but concerning the rights of large bodies of citizens. In other words, we have the majority making the rules for the majority. That's allowing people to be judges in their own case, Madison says. In other words, we don't have a separation of powers into executive, legislative, and judicial under the Articles of Confederation. Basically, we have one branch of government, the Congress, the union of the states that makes all the rules. They are the executive, they are the judiciary, and they are the legislative. And Madison said, you can't have this. This allows people to make laws that benefit themselves. I mean, it's that simple. And, of course, he's worried about the fact. Remember, he has said, majorities are ruling in our states. That's the problem. And he goes on, and what are the different classes of legislators but advocates and parties to the causes which they determine? Is a law proposed concerning private debts? It is a question to which the creditors are parties on one side and the debtors on the other. Justice ought to hold the balance between them. A neutral third party ought to make the call. Yet the parties are and must be themselves the judges, and the most numerous party, or in other words, the most powerful faction, must be expected to prevail. So if there's a contest between creditors and debtors, and if the majority is going to rule, that means the debtors are going to write the law. That's the problem of the Confederation period to Madison. The wrong faction is calling the shots, the majority faction. Shall domestic manufacturers be encouraged, and in what degree? By restrictions on foreign manufacturers. So Madison is suggesting here, should there be a law raising tariffs against foreign manufacturers in order to help local manufacturers? These are questions which would be differently decided by the landed and the manufacturing classes, and probably by neither with a sole regard to justice and the public good. In other words, when a question like this comes up, self-interest always prevails, Madison says. Never, rarely, without regard to justice and the public good. The apportionment of taxes on the various descriptions of property is an act which seemed to require the most exact impartiality. One would assume that tax laws ought to be written not by people who have, who have skin in the game, so to speak, but people who are impartial. Yet there is perhaps no legislative act in which greater opportunity and temptation are given to a predominant party to trample on the rules of justice. Every shilling with which they overburden the inferior number is a shilling saved to their own pockets. Basically, what he's again saying, if tax law is going to be written in the legislatures, and if the majority is going to write the laws, and if the majority are the debtors and the poor, then it stands to reason that the majority is going to pass tax legislation that benefits themselves and overtaxes the successful. It stands to reason, because since the successful are the minority, they can't protect themselves in a majority rule situation. And that's what we have in our state governments under the Confederation. Madison is explaining exactly what the problems of the Confederation are as he sees them. The problems are within the state legislatures themselves. And he goes on and makes one more comment, which I'll get to very quickly, and then I'll get to his solution. It is in vain to say that enlightened statesmen will be able to adjust these clashing interests and render them all subservient to the public good. In other words, we are naive to believe that enlightened statesmen, civic-minded representatives, are going to come and adjust these clashing interests and find a way to render them all subservient to the public good. Wouldn't it be great if somebody was going to come in on a white horse and save the day by saying, wait a minute, guys, you're all looking out for your own self-interest. We need to protect the public interest. Let's do what's right. Madison said, wouldn't it be great if that were true? But it's not going to happen. Enlightened statesmen will not always be at the helm, nor in many cases can such an adjustment be made at all. without taking into view indirect and remote considerations, which will rarely prevail over the immediate interest which one party may find in disregarding the rights of another or the good of the whole. In other words, there are so many impediments, so many things that make it impossible for us to believe that the public interest, justice, is ever going to prevail over private interest in this kind of an environment, that we're wasting our time if we continue to hope that the situation is going to get better on its own. We have got to take the bull by the horns and fix this, Madison says. Now, his solution. The inference to which we are brought, Madison says, is that the causes of faction cannot be removed, and that relief can only be sought in the means of controlling its effects. Going back, remember Madison said, there are two ways to address the issues of faction. One is to eliminate the causes, the other is control the effects. Then he said there are two ways to eliminate the causes. One is take away freedom, the other one is to make everybody the same, eliminate factions. He has gone through each of those and showed how neither one of those is possible. So now he comes back to the original issue. If there are two ways, one eliminating the causes and the other controlling the effects, then we have reached the point where our only solution is to find a way to control the effects of factions. We can't get rid of them. We can't tamper with man's freedom. We can't make everybody the same. We can't interfere with private property. Government's one number one priority is to protect people's freedom to acquire property and to have that protected. There's no way we can get around it. So to eliminate the causes of factions is impossible. So Madison said, the conclusion that we have reached, the point where we have reached, is the only way out of this is to find a way to deal with the effects of factions. And now he's going to explain how that will work. And he did this in number 10, in vice number 10, in his Vices of the Political System. But this almost reads like a song. It's almost melodic. If a faction, Madison says, consists of less than a majority, relief is supplied by the Republican principle, which enables the majority to defeat its sinister views by regular vote. It may clog the administration, it may convulse society, but it will be unable to execute and mask its violence under the forms of the Constitution. Madison, remember he has said, a faction can either be a majority or a minority. Now Madison's saying, if a faction is the minority, if a faction consists of less than the majority, relief is supplied by the Republican principle. The majority will always outvote it. So we don't have to worry about the minority. Notice what he's saying. Who is the majority? Who is the minority? The minority are the property owners. The minority are the most considerate and virtuous citizens. And Madison is saying, they are not our problem. They are not our problem. Because if they try to do something evil, the majority will outvote them. Now, that's an assumption if I ever heard one. He said the minority faction may clog the administration, it might convulse society, but it will be unable to execute and mask its violence under the forms of the Constitution. It may cause all sorts of trouble, but because it is a minority, it will never be able to perpetrate the self-interest that it seeks. Now Madison is going to the real issue. When a majority is included in a faction, he says, the form of popular government, on the other hand, enables it to sacrifice to its ruling passion or interest both the public good and the rights of other citizens. Madison is saying the major problem we face is the majority faction, the ones without the property. When a majority is included in the faction, Madison says, the form of popular government, on the other hand, enables it to sacrifice to its ruling passion or interest the public good and the rights of other citizens. We can't trust the majority, the Republican form of government, majority rule, to fix the problem when the majority faction is the problem, because the majority rules. So the very nature of government itself enables the majority faction to execute its evil, to sacrifice to its own ruling passion or interest the public good and the rights of others. What Madison is saying is majority rule is evil. Majority rule is the problem. And in the structure of government that we've got right now, which is susceptible to majority rule, we are allowing the majority faction to write the rules, to make the laws, to make the policy, to be judges in their own case, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then Madison presents what I think is the second most important line, sentence, in this document. Because here he explains what government is about. To secure the public good and private rights against the danger of such a faction, and at the same time to preserve the spirit and the form of popular government, is then the great object to which our inquiries are directed. Wow, wow, wow. Madison says, the great object to which our inquiries are directed, our major challenge, Madison says, is to secure the public good and private rights against the danger of such a faction, against majority rule, to protect the minority from the majority. Our major challenge is not to create a democracy, but to make sure that we do not have one. To make sure that the majority faction can never rule. He goes on. And at the same time, to preserve the spirit and the form of popular government. We have to do this without sacrificing our commitment to popular government. We must remain a republic. But we must be a republic in which the majority faction can never seize power. It can never get control. It can never make the rules. Madison says that is the great object to which our inquiries are directed. And then he adds an addendum and said, let me add that it is the great desideratum by which this form of government can be rescued from the opprobrium under which it has so long labored and be recommended to the esteem and adoption of mankind. Basically, what he's saying is if we're able to pull this off, we're able to do this, this will be the solution for mankind from time immemorial forever, Madison said. Wow. I've heard some people interpret this to say, basically, our major objective in the Constitution is to create a government which the people can't control, but which looks like a government that they do control. That's what Otto told Vergen in 1786, if you remember, at the end of the Annapolis Convention. That ultimately the people believe one thing. They believe by voting a certain way they are accomplishing one thing, but in reality they are accomplishing something quite different, but they don't know what it is. And I think you can explain the reasons here by saying, if a faction consists of less than a majority, Madison is not saying our problem is not the minority faction because it'll always be outvoted by the majority. He doesn't say that. That's in effect what he's saying. But what he says is if a faction consists of less than a majority, that's the minority. So let me go back and make one point which I think is significant. If Madison's number one goal in the Constitution of the United States is to create a government in which the people participate but can never seize control of, a government which the majority faction can never control, then what Madison is saying, by inference, by omission, if his job is to make sure that the majority faction can never control government, then effectively he is saying that this government is one which the minority must always control. Think about that. somebody is in control. Somebody's making the rules. Somebody's writing the laws. Somebody's passing the laws. And if your number one objective is to create a government which the majority faction can't control, then effectively what you are doing is creating a government which the minority faction can control, will control. And I think that's very significant. One other thing. Madison has said that we have all these different factions. We have a landed interest, a mercantile interest, a manufacturing interest, a moneyed interest. We have all this interests forming factions, and Madison's suggestion is they will be competitors for their own self-interest against each other. But it's important to recognize this fact. When the focus is on the majority faction, those without property, then by definition, the different minority factions will unite and coalesce against that threat. In other words, when your perspective is focused on the majority faction, then all these minor elements of the minority faction seeks to exist because they are all threatened by the majority faction. So in a sense, what you are doing is making sure that the property and those whose priority interests are the freedom to secure property and the right to have it protected is the number one priority of government. The way you are guaranteeing, the way you are ensuring that is by making sure that they are the faction that controls government, those with property. And this is reflected throughout America during this period. Every single state has property qualifications for voting and office holding. The state that I know best because I wrote my dissertation on it is the state of Maryland. In Maryland, you could not vote unless you owned property valued at 50 pounds, 50 British pounds. In order to be a candidate for local office or for the state legislature, you had to have property valued at 100 pounds. In order to be a candidate for the upper house of the legislature in Maryland, which was the Senate, the state Senate, you had to have property valued at 1,000 pounds. In order to be a candidate for governor, you had to own property valued at 5,000 pounds. Now, what does that tell us? It tells us that the operative assumption behind those laws was that the more property you own, the more intelligent and better office holder you will be. The more important the office, the wealthier you have to be. The assumption is we are putting the priority responsibility in the hands of the people who have demonstrated by the amount of property they own an ability to handle that particular responsibility. So the more, the greater the responsibility, the more property the property owner must hold. And the operative assumption is if you don't have any property, if you can't meet the minimum qualifications of property valued at 50 pounds, you cannot vote at all. And the reason for that is what historians have labeled, for lack of a better term, the idea that you have skin in the game. That ultimately, if you have no property, that means you have nothing to lose. That means your number one objective is to secure property. Your self-interest drives you. But the belief is, if you have property, 50 pounds worth, you have a stake in society. You have a vested interest in being a good citizen. You have a vested interest in operating according to the rules of government because government is protecting your property, your 50 pounds worth of property. So the basic operative assumption is what is called the stake in society. The idea that only property owners can be trusted to make the rules. Those without property are dangerous. We can't let them vote. and the more important the responsibility of the office, the more we must require that the office holder own. The wealthiest people control the major offices, the governor's office, the senator's office, etc. But you have to have a minimum. And, of course, the reality, as historians have found out in doing research, the reality is that the availability of land during that period made the ownership of 50 acres rather easy. If you were willing to work, you could acquire property. So what that meant was that if there was somebody who didn't have property, you had to watch them, because obviously if the opportunity was there, then the fact that they do not own property, it probably means that they chose not to work it. And those kinds of people you need to be careful about. So there's an awful lot of meaning that comes out of this legislation and out of these laws. So what Madison is suggesting, what Madison is saying then, he's not suggesting it, that the number one objective of government is to secure the public good and private rights property against the danger of majority rule, while at the same time preserving the spirit and the form of popular government. That's what this is all about. And Madison said, let me add that it is the great desideratum by which this form of government can be rescued from the opprobrium. In other words, if we can pull this off, we're going to save the reputation of Republican government if we can make this work. Isn't this brilliant? Can you imagine the creativity and the brilliance of this? This is fabulous. Okay, now Madison's going to go into, how do we do this? How do we basically preserve the spirit and the form of popular government and at the same time create a situation which the majority can never control? And Madison said, by what means is this object attainable? How do we do this? Evidently by one of two only. Either the existence of the same passion or interest in a majority at the same time must be prevented. Listen to this. This is absolutely gold. This is golden. Each word is golden. Either the existence of the same passion or interest in a majority at the same time must be prevented, or the majority, having such coexistent passion or interest, must be rendered by their number and local situation unable to concert and carry into effect schemes of oppression. How do we do this, Madison says? By one of two ways. Either the existence of the same passion or interest in a majority at the same time must be prevented. What that means is we must find ways to make sure that there is never a majority. Now, how do you do that? Well, let me give you some examples from American history of the way we've done it. If educated people are uncomfortable with uneducated people, if city people are not comfortable with country people, if Catholics can't get along with Protestants, if Protestants and Catholics can't get along with Jews, if blacks can't get along with whites, if those of Irish descent can't get along with those of English descent, if those who speak English are distrustful of those who can't speak English. In other words, the more minority factions there are within society, the less likely there will be a majority faction. What makes the majority faction? The recognition that their lack of property is what they all have in common. Madison is saying, you got to make sure that they never are able to see that. And the way you do it is you emphasize the differences between them. The old idea of divide and conquer. Think about it. Madison went into this document suggesting that we need to find a way to control the violence of factions. He has now reached the point where the very existence of factions is the only way to guarantee the security and peace of government. A government that saw factions as the greatest threat to order becomes a government which must have factions in order to preserve order. What a brilliant, brilliant system. Either the existence of the same passion or interest in a majority at the same time must be prevented, or the majority having such codes. In other words, if there is a majority, it must be rendered by number and local situation unable to concert and carry into effect its schemes of oppression. If there is a majority, what you do is you spread it out so much that the members never know that they're part of a majority. Until the majority organizes, it doesn't exist. And if you create large constituencies made up of so many competing local factions, small factions, chances are you'll never have a majority faction. Or even if you do, they'll be so spread out that they won't know they're part of a majority faction until the majority organizes, it can't function. Therefore, those in the minority faction have a vested interest in practicing divide and conquer among the poor. That's the basis, not of disorder in society, but that's the basis of order in society, is making sure that the majority faction can never organize. This is what makes Twitters and texting and the internet and emails so dangerous. Contemporary technology is making it possible to unite the majority faction in ways that we could never unite it before. Madison would be scared to death. He would be rolling in his grave at the internet, at the capabilities of today's society, because the ability of technology to organize people, and all we need to do is look at what's happening in the world, the toppling of the Mubarak government in Egypt, what's going on in Syria, the situation in throughout the Middle East. We're talking about cell phone revolutions here. We're talking about the ability of those without power to unite and organize and pull off revolutions through their ability to communicate. Madison's faith in the stability of our political system was grounded on the fact that that kind of unity, that kind of organization, that kind of communication would never be possible. So how is Madison going to do this? We're moving towards the end of our program today, so I want to bring this to a logical conclusion. What Madison is advocating is moving popular sovereignty from the state level to the national level by creating a national government that will have the power to tax and the power to raise an army and the power to do all the things that the Constitution says. You preserve the spirit and the form of popular government, but you make congressional districts so large that you make it impossible for the majority faction to rule. The only way for the majority faction to rule in a national, from a national perspective, in a national context, is to organize a national majority. How do you do that? Well, we're seeing efforts to do it in our political system today. We are seeing efforts to do it. Madison would be frightened to death by what's happening through technology in our world today. What Madison is suggesting, and he says this, from this view of the subject, he says, it may be concluded that pure democracy, by which I mean a society consisting of a small number of citizens who assemble and administer the government in person, can admit of no cure for the mischiefs of factions. Madison said democracy is not the solution to our problem. Damn it, it is the problem. But he doesn't say that. Madison says a common passion or interest in almost every case will be felt by a majority of the whole. If you have a small constituency, like power on the state level under the Confederation. If you have a small area, you make it more likely that a common passion or interest will create the majority. And the system of government itself, which is based on majority rule, gives them all they need to enforce, to carry out the will of the majority faction. A common interest or passion, he says, in almost every case will be felt by a majority of the whole. A communication and concert result from the form of government itself, and there's nothing to check the inducements to sacrifice the weaker party or an obnoxious individual. Hence, it is that such democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention, have ever been found incompatible with personal security or the rights of property, and have in general been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths. Small republics don't work, Madison says, because they are too susceptible to majority rule. The only way to fix this is to create a republic, a national republic, a government in which the scheme of representation takes place is the answer to our question. What he's going to talk about doing is removing power from the state level because it's too susceptible to majority rule and moving it to the national level, which means that the only way to control it is by a national majority, and that can never happen, Madison believed. So the result is that you have created a government which is free from the pressure of majority rule, yet at the same time you have preserved a, you have created a government which preserves the spirit and the form of popular government. It remains a republic, it remains popular, it remains participatory, it remains dependent on its citizens, it remains dependent on the elections and votes of its citizens for elected representatives. Basically, what you have done is you have preserved the spirit and the form of popular government, but you have taken power out of the hands of the majority, and you have guaranteed that power will be wielded by the minority. And with that, I think we are at 57 minutes after the hour. I think we've reached the end of our time together, not only for today, but for this week's program. We'll be back on Monday with another session of the Virtual Center for the Study of the U.S. Constitution. I'm Bill O'Brien. I hope you have a wonderful week and weekend. I think winter's finally going to end here in the mountains. Everything I hear suggests that. And we'll be back on Monday, and we can pick up with this, and we can play with it a little bit on Monday before we move into something else. I'm Bill O'Brien. I want to thank you so much for being with us. Have a good day, a good evening, a good week, and a good weekend. Please be safe, and we'll get back together again. Thank you.